on a bend in the road, my motorcycle and I parted company at speed. Wasn't the first time. Won't be the last. No, it was the last. Despite the stripes of blood, some people came and stopped and helped me. Some of them even knew first aid. And St John's ambulance arrived and took me to the emergency department of the Royal North Shore Hospital, and I was admitted. Nobody looked at my wallet. And they treated me with wisdom that goes back 2.5 millennia. Incredible care. I'm not the first to feel I was, though. I was in the presence of angels. And that heavenly reference is not an accident. The Christians have actually done incredible things in creating, shaping, and spreading healthcare throughout the world, not just with pioneer persons who will tell some stories, but also some driving principles that come out of Christianity, which we'll just unpack slightly. Some people claim that Christians invented healing, and that's simply not the case. There were people inventing medicine well before Jesus. In fact, every culture tries to heal its sick. And there are some fantastic stories from probably the pagan herbalists and their attempts to find a way to relieve the suffering of their brave people, right through to the great geniuses of compilation of wisdom like Galen and Buktishu. Well, they don't actually try to heal all their sick. The evidence seems to be, from one scholar, that healthcare tends to be directed towards people who have the money. And they're the only ones who get it, or they're favourites. They're favourites. But I'm not either of those. So how come they let me into that hospital and treated me with extraordinary care? The earliest credible claim I can find for a hospital system like that is from India and from Buddhism. A young Chinese monk named Fa Jian, pardon my pronunciation, went to India looking for signs of the Buddha and found a hospital system that had been spread across North India, he thought, by the great Buddhist emperor Ashoka. We're not sure about that. Fa Jian said, "The heads of the merchant families in North India established in the cities houses for dispensing charity and medicine. All the poor and destitute in the country are provided with every kind of help, and doctors examine their diseases, and they get the food and medicine they need, and when they're well, they go away of themselves." Isn't that superb? What a great picture. Clearly, Fa Jian, as a young Buddhist monk, saw that it was the flowering of a strong culture of spirituality, in his case Buddhist. Already he makes a connection where it appears, where he sees it. However, standing in the very same place some centuries later, Vishal Mangalwadi, an Indian scholar, observed that none of that remained. He also observed that of the great wealth and great genius in medicine and other things of the Gangetic, of the, you know, the civilizations around the Ganges, Buddhist or Hindu, it wasn't until the 19th century when Christian missionaries arrived that schools and hospitals were spread around the country again. He examines why. He did observe, however, that what was remaining, what had endured, were what was called Unani Dawakanas. Sorry about the pronunciation again. Translated, Greek medicine houses. Greek medicine houses all through India? They were herbalists. What were the Greeks doing with medicine in India? Well, the answer to that is quite interesting. Let's say it's all down to Basil. I don't mean Basil of Fawlty Towers on the television. I mean Bishop Basil of Cappadocia. It goes like this. He, as a bishop, had attended the church council in Constantinople in the year 360 of the Christian era. That was one of the first public meetings that the church had ever held since it had been released from centuries of persecution. And Basil returned from that council with an idea. A hospital next to every church. And so he did it. It was called the Basiliad after him in history. And even in its time, it was known as one of the wonders of the world. A leprosarium, a hospital, a hospice, residences, almshouses, and so on. But he didn't think of the idea. Because far away on the opposite side from Constantinople, in Rome, a laywoman named Fabiola had started the first of what would be two hospitals in the Roman vicinity, doing the same thing. Somehow or other, they'd got the same idea at the same council. She herself served in that hospital until she died in 399. Both initiatives, in the East and in the West, endured and spread. They were radical in their day. Howard Haggard, the historian of medicine, says, "The Romans often fled when epidemics broke out for fear, and they left the sick to die without care." That was the culture in which this was happening. Helping a sick person was to be a loser. It was a sign of weakness to the Romans. Whereas the Christians, in the light of what Jesus taught, believed they were not only serving the sick, but serving God. At the time of Basil, the emperor was Julian. He worshipped Greek idols. And he lamented the behaviour of the Christians. "It's disgraceful that when no Jew ever has to beg, and the impious Galileans," that was his word for Christians, "support not only their own poor but ours as well, that everyone sees that our people lack aid from us. Teach those of the Hellenic faith to contribute to public service of that sort." That debate continues today, yeah? Julian was being shown up. Let me frame this clearly. As soon as the Christian church was allowed to operate in public, emerging from persecution and secrecy and underground, it built public hospitals next to churches, using all the medical knowledge they could scramble together, as well as praying in their liturgies for the healing and the anointing of the sick. As soon as we popped our heads out of our foxholes, as Julian said, for their poor and for ours as well. By the middle of the 6th century, in most of Christendom, East and West, hospitals were established. Some maintained libraries, research and training programs. Inpatient medical care, like what we get to see today, is not an invention of Christian mercy alone. There is room, plenty of room for collaboration and learning. The Christian gift was that it was widely spread, established for the common good, and sustained as a public priority over the narrower demands of wealth and empire that were always pressing. We'll come back to that. The gift was given. Within a few centuries, Christians had carried and shared this gift far and wide, scientific, international, and interfaith. In Persia, the Academy of Gundishvar, with Christian leadership, took it up, and it spread across Asia. The same in Damascus in the 8th century. The Muslim medicine took it up, and from there to Baghdad, which sparked hospitals across the Arab Empire. By the mid-1500s, one sociologist records, there was 37,000 monasteries caring for the sick. King Henry VIII closed the monasteries, and so hospitals started to become secular. This story of Christian pioneers continues into the modern era. For example, Thomas Percival of epidemiology and medical ethics, James Simpson, who invented chloroform, Louis Pasteur discovered bacteria, Jean-Henri Girard, who invented the Red Cross and now Red Crescent, Florence Nightingale, who reformed nursing, was called by God at the age of 17, she says. Dorothy Dix, yes, Dorothy Dix is a real person, and Philippe Pernell, both Christians, who reformed mental hospitals, and so on. Way too many stories. Look up the website. There's a few Nobel Prize winners amongst them, but mostly they're those thousands of invisible medical missionaries who practice all across the world to this day. Some of you are amongst them. Today, healthcare attracts the best and the brightest. A life-giving Christian tide. I forgot to say where the ambulance came from. You know, it took 950 years for that ambulance to arrive at me. It started out from Jerusalem and went through 42 countries. Anyway, look it up on the website. The Order of St. John explicitly still claims itself to be a Christian movement. So my thanks go to all those pioneers named and those many thousands of others unnamed who personally shaped healthcare for the common good in Christian values. That's what got me into that hospital. Will it be the same for my grandchildren? And it wasn't just certain persons of kind persons. You know, there's always nice kind persons around, fortunately. But there were three Christian principles that were driving this to be the way it was. The first is the Good Samaritan, our formula for action. This is the earthquake at the centre of the movement. The scene is a man is beaten up and left to die. And he's bypassed by certain religious persons who leave him there. But a Samaritan businessman does stop and tends his wounds and then arranges for his ongoing care. At the end of the story, Jesus says, "Go and do likewise." So believers did. We have gone all through the world and all through our neighbourhood and outside our own postcode to seek out those who need care. As a personal ethic, it's difficult enough, but you need to hear the reverberation that in Jesus' time it was politically inflammatory. His people and the Samaritans loved to hate each other. No one that Jesus was speaking to ever thought to follow the role model of a Samaritan. And that's what Jesus says we must do. Those days are upon us again. It's the formula, the new normal. This still lingers somewhat as a moral norm in this post-Christian generation. But that light is fading. The second Christian principle that drives this is the meaning of miracles. All the witnesses in Jesus' time saw him perform what Josephus Flavius, the Jew, called mighty deeds. We would use the word miracle. I've been witness to two miracles myself, so I don't think these are just metaphors. Jesus did not heal everyone, so it's not our formula for action. We don't build miracle houses, we build clinics. John's Gospel says these miracles are signs, and they point in two directions. One is that at base, have no mistake, when God shows up, God is merciful, not vengeful. Make no mistake. That's what miracles say. That's what they point to. The second thing they point to is, do you expect God to use you very much? Look what can happen. Jesus, it says, is poised to act incredibly. If you just do the Good Samaritan thing. It's the formula for attitude. Miracles. So when we set up the clinic, we run services of healing prayer and we anoint people with oil. We've always done it. We'll do it today. This is how we have seen him at work amongst us. The third Christian principle after the miracles is love. The wholeness of love. Health only rises holistically. It's kind of obvious as soon as you say it, but let me just point out that we know, for instance, that if you're psychologically depressed, physical exercise works. The body and the soul connected. We know that grief causes doubt. And we know that having a meaningless life causes exhaustion. All these things are connected. Just two things about that. It's no wonder that a lot of scientific studies have now shown that effectual interconnection between spirituality and prayer and health and well-being. And I'm meaning many hundreds of academic studies, you know, double-blind controls, proximal intercessory prayer, and I stopped at 500 academic studies of the effect which can be measured. One of my colleagues says it ranges from a study that he did in Adelaide, from small but statistically significant influence through to some records I've read are 200 or 300% improvements, or one heart study said 14 times more effective when the prayer and spirituality things were there. Now, it depends on what aspect they were studying, of one aspect of spirituality or what aspect of the healing process. But these studies now simply refute any notion that to include spirituality in the healing process is snake oil or placebo. What did Jesus mean by holism in our current word? Jesus defined a whole person, and the word for healed and saved were the same in Greek, as one who loved God with all their heart, soul, mind and strength. You can see him gathering a whole person in, and loves their neighbour as they love themselves, the inner and the outer. It's brilliant, just sheer brilliance. The most economically brilliant statement I've ever heard in my life. It is comprehensive, it is simple, it is wise, you can achieve it. You can know when you're doing it. That's Jesus' holism. It's about being in love with God and being loved with the neighbours. Incredible. So any wise health carer will help love happen. They won't just follow the principles of efficiency, professionalism, economy, so-called, what people today call science anyway, objectivity and so on. It's certainly not budget. It's a factor. They're all good factors. But the big deal is the holism that comes from this kind of love. Richard Rohr, the Franciscan, says, only love can be trusted with wisdom. All other attitudes, he says, will murder and mangle and manipulate truth for their own ego purposes. Is it sounding like your medical team? Maybe I could call these three principles seek, pray, love. Make a movie and make a fortune. But that's why Christians have done what we've done. And I wish this was the story all the time. Let me, as an ordained minister of the church, now say how sorry I am, not for things we knew too late, but for things we knew and turned against ourselves, our hypocrisy, our corruption. I want to give three examples. Despite such a great track record for healing, the church thought we owned it. So now, when it comes to discussions about critical issues, we spoil the discussion. What is that? particularly around beginning and end of life issues, you know, abortion, birth control, euthanasia. Put probably too simply, when we keep saying in our arguments, look, life is sacred, that's not actually helping the argument, that's closing it down. And no wonder then that the conversation degenerates from there. The church should have a voice, but not a veto. When we say doctors are playing God, we say that when we're turning our own view into an absolute. We're the ones that are playing God when we say that. Christian theology says this, since we've ever had theology, in every department of the human being is a flaw, body, soul, mind and strength. We all know we're limited. But it does mean, doesn't it, that every construct of human rationality can never be called absolute. Even a biblical interpretation can never be called absolute because we believe we're flawed in our minds as well as the rest of us. That's what Christians have always believed. But when we play God, we didn't. Suddenly we accrued power to ourselves. There's the problem. We used to pursue and take responsibility within life, but now we just define free will. No wonder then that some church leaders have acted as though they are above reproach. When church leaders are found in error and in crime, it's not just them who are doing it. We have played God. Please forgive us. And don't ever let us get away with doing that. Second apology. People are often in the midst of suffering. And you know, the ignorant amongst us have been allowed to say various stupid things like, God must have wanted her more than you and took her to himself. Or there must be a reason. Or just pray about it. Or God is sovereign and nothing happens outside his will. Or you must have done something to deserve this. And so on. These are not Christian beliefs. With the biblical gospels and the book of Job open on your lectern, how did ever any clergy learn to say such trash? And why did they not teach their flock when to shut up? For such stinging comfort, I truly, deeply apologize. And another thing, false hope. There are some who replace the meaning of miracles with magic formula for healing. They put out to desperate people the idea, the false idea, that you'll get your healing if you just pray the right way or with the right faith or with a pure enough heart or with a big enough donation or if you leave that mob and join us. So when that magic formula prayer fails, as it does, then the person feels, or even somebody might say, oh, you're not good enough. You have little faith. It's cruel. Against Jesus' explicit teaching, they exploit the vulnerable with false hope, which breeds false condemnation and increases the hurt. I am so sorry. I don't know how we got to that. There are other corruptions of the church that I'll talk about in other talks. Fortunately, Christian medical conferences around the world discuss these things, and elders school the younger doctors in ethical integrity. Absolutely indispensable. But I want to finish with just two things about the future. Two areas for potential collaboration in healthcare today, and it needs this, I believe. Neither of these two things require that healthcare ceases to be secular. Make that clear. We are so aware of our potential for corruption, even today, that we do need to hang on to collaborative balance of powers in the way we go forward. But here are two things that I'm going to challenge you with. The great challenge that I hear most of the time from medicos is that medicine has changed from being a service of healing to being an organisation about budgets. What's driving that? How did we get to that? Well, some say the rising healthcare costs around the world are driven by the high cost of medical procedures and pharmaceuticals, or by the high cost of medical education, or the high cost of insurance against litigation, being sued. And others say it's the ageing baby boomer generation. That population bubble is now getting older. These are all raw costs. They need attention, but I don't think they're the big problem. The bigger truth is actually hiding in plain sight. An international study of 30 years' duration has consistently come up internationally and also with sub-regional comparison with the same result. It's called spirit level, but it's not to do with Holy Spirit or anything religious at all. It's just about a carpenter. You know, they put a spirit level on to see how level things are. That's all it is. That's all they mean. The huge leap in healthcare costs across the world are mainly from duplication and triplication of healthcare systems in highly unequal societies. You can see quite a number of countries, from Japan in the bottom left to the USA in the far off the scale at the top right. And down the right, a whole lot of social outcomes that go with this. They come in a package deal. In other words, there's one medical system for the low income. There's another one for the medically insured, and yet another elite medical system for those who can buy it. Now, if you're multiplying medical systems and building extra hospitals, it dwarfs all of those raw cost factors. And in Australia, where I'm standing now, we are following the health system of the country off the scale at the top right with the worst social outcomes from doing this. All these things are not just raw costs, they're political priorities. The choice in plain sight is this. Do we want our grandchildren to see and experience the priority of courageous compassion for the common good, or the priority of those who can hold wealth and want choices? There's your choice. If ever, in my view, there was a time for the spirit of Basil and Fabiola, it is now. The second collaboration, we can go back to, is to recover the connection between spirituality and well-being. Not because I want to follow a religious agenda, well, maybe I do a bit, but because humans are not warm meat. It's that holism thing again. And I would say, if doctors want to practice scientific medicine, which I hope they do, then let them study their science better. All those studies I've mentioned. would help them to recover the healing benefits of various aspects of spirituality. And it's not a simplistic little study. There is much more to gain besides having a lunchtime session on mindfulness, though it has benefits. I know this is beginning in some sectors. I hope this advances the matter a lot further. I've been arguing for what Christianity has done for us in healthcare across the world. You can change healthcare if you wish, but know what remains. I've identified specific corruptions within, but falling from a sustained, widespread, and positive line of action for the common good. The church has been an hospitable community of Christ. Our track record is that we spread the hope and the compassion of Christ. Our story is that we lived up to our high calling in Christ. Other religions will tell you, and other scientists will tell you, we collaborated in the name of Christ. This is our story. It's what he told us we could do. I hope you now have fresh grounds for a fresh consideration of this culture. I think that story's wicked. And I won't be getting back on my motorcycle. Thank you.